But I'm delighted to say on a mammoth show today, we have our first guest ready and waiting to join us on the line. He's a man who we're about as happy to see as Real Madrid were as happy to see Xabi Alonso back in the starting lineup last night. That's right, joining us here on World Football Daily, the creative mastermind, the playmaker, if you will, of all things Spanish football journalism. It is, of course, the one, the only Mr. Graham Hunter joining us here on WFD to talk to us all things La Liga and Champions League action. Graham, an absolute pleasure to have you on the board today. How are you, mate? It's a pleasure to have you back.
Morning, legend. Not even the slightest bit tired after a 6 a.m. Spain start after last night's Real Sociedad game against Manchester United, and looking forward to today's fascinating Barcelona-Milan game. The Champions League demands a lot, not just from the players and administrators, but from the journals too, believe me.
Will you be heading off to UEFA and petitioning with other managers that you maybe there should be a bigger break between these fixtures? We should have less games in the season as well then, Graham?
If I didn't feel such sympathy for the players, which I genuinely do, I'd be petitioning for double the number of games. The Champions League is the Rolls Royce of football competitions. It's utterly spellbinding and brilliant. And if I could be at 4, 5, 6 of the Champions League games per week, then I would. I'd love to see them spread out over 3 days. It's honestly, it's, I'm not going to say it's addictive. It's one of the modern things that encapsulates the very reason that I fell in love with football as a 6, 7 year old, despite the framework and the ideals and the promotion, the coverage of football being utterly different in the 30s when I was young. But I think that you see such spectacle, such excitement, such talent, that and such pitting of wits by coaches against each other. It's been responsible, the Champions League, really, for, you know, a complete change in mentality about attacking football and about how winning away from home should be as easy, should be as routine as winning at home. You know, when you grew up in my era, where teams went for stultifying, you know, our hands around the throat defence, and you play 5 men at the back, not a free man, but 4 plus 1 behind and a goalkeeper. When you imagine all that and you look at what we're given now, to me the Champions League is a gift from on high. And I'd genuinely like to be at 40 or 50 of the games per year if I could. I'm a total aficionado.
Are you in favour then of maybe expanding the Champions League, as has been discussed on occasions by UEFA, or even this European Super League that's been proposed on a couple of occasions as well, Graham? Do you think it should be taken a step further?
I'm very, very, very hesitant about that. For as long as I've been a journalist, there have been stories about Super Leagues. I was at a paper dealing with them when we broke the entire story of a planned Super League where funds had been set aside and teams were meeting, and there was a direct challenge to UEFA in that it would have been a breakaway, a separate commercial league, not the European Clubs Association, which is now like a lobbyist and contains the biggest voices, the biggest clubs in European football, and chivvies UEFA along into line on revenues and in terms of rules, in terms of organization, but lobbying UEFA from within the tent. This one was outside the tent, urinating in, if you use the political expression. And I can't explain to you why I grew up equally fascinated by European continental football, European football, as I did with domestic football. But it has always been that way. The European Cup, the Cup Winners' Cup, which Aberdeen won when I was 20 or whatever, equally, and the UEFA Cup, they mean something to me. There are other people like me. I remember, if your listeners remember, Alec McLeish, who won the European Companies Cup with Aberdeen as a centre-back next to Willie Miller, and latterly, you know, played 80-something times for Scotland and latterly coached at Rangers and at Birmingham and Aston Villa and Scotland. I know that, you know, in an Aberdeen era when there was no internet, when there was no Sky Television, when you couldn't get magazines on European football regularly, he'd come in as a 17, 18-year-old to Pittodrie in the late 70s, early 80s, talking like, did you see what Bordeaux did at the weekend? Did you see what Valencia did at the weekend, or isn't it interesting how Dupla Praga are playing, and the players around him, these seasoned players who would go on to beat Bayern Munich and beat Real Madrid, looked at him with dismay as if to say, what the hell are you on? Mm-hmm. And he's like me. There are other people who are just like, it's in your blood, and therefore, when you get, I was sceptical earlier about the dismantling of the old Champions Cup, the European Cup, knockout, champions only. I was, and I was wrong. And I think that the Champions League now is a brilliant competition. I'm very hostile in my columns to people, particularly in England, media commentators in England, who say, well, it's a bit boring, it's always the same teams. And they open their mouth without engaging the brain because, you know, we have seen Manchester City failing to qualify from the group stage, Manchester United failing to qualify from the group stage, Jose Mourinho being dismissed at Chelsea after a surprise European home defeat against a Scandinavian side. We see shocks like Bayern Munich dismantling Barcelona 7-0. We see glorious, and I mean glorious, football like the 2011 Barcelona Wembley final against Manchester United. We see extraordinary, unscriptable nonsense like 1999, mm-hmm. where the people who are going to hand the cups over have got all the blue and red, or red, you know, black and blue Bayern Munich ribbons tied on the cup and walked down the Camp Nou stairs, and by the time they amble out onto the pitch, United have won it. You see the most extraordinary human drama, brilliant skill. I go back to what I said about men pitting their wits against each other in terms of planning, in terms of reaction during the game, in terms of how to handle the press conference pre and post. Why change it? I'm sceptical. Unless it's clubs saying, we just want a bigger cake and a bigger share of that bigger cake. Now, economics are vital to keep the game alive, but at the moment, I'd rather see better resource husbandry by clubs than say, let's make let's be more gluttonous about how we give the public European football. At the moment, I'd need, if I were in charge, I'd need extraordinarily strong persuasion that there's very much wrong with this Champions League format right now.
Well, Graham, I'm sure there's many of our listeners that would be happy to put you in charge with your thoughts and expertise on the game.
There'd be probably just as many who'd be happy to put me right.
I tell you what, we'll see if they can email in, and then we'll send
it out there.
We'll send
it. I want to know
how would if you put Graham Hunter in charge, how would you allow him to change football? We'll see what we get back from that. In the meantime, talking of great moments in Champions League football and great games. Did Juventus Real Madrid for you meet that high standard? It was, to me, watching it, an absolutely engrossing game of football.
No, I agree with your second part there. It did. It sucked you in. You couldn't help but feel all the past dramas, not just between the two clubs. The last time I was at that particular tie in Turin, he was at the Stadio delle Alpi, and Juventus were putting out, Zlatan Juventus were putting out Michael Owen's Real Madrid. We saw a red card, I believe it was Ronaldo for Real Madrid. I was also at the Amsterdam final in 98 when pre-match Jupankas, the Madrid coach, was asked, if you win the European Cup, if you win the fabled Septima, the seventh European Cup, do you think that will be enough to keep your job? No, he said it won't. He did win it and it didn't keep his job. And I thought that last night's drama had, and you could hear those grace notes from the past calling to you. You could see the tension of the Ancelotti-Conte clash, the two Italian coaches. While Ancelotti had been Juve coach, he was unsuccessful. He's not particularly liked in Turin because he's so much of a Rome and Milan legend. And the one thing I would say is that I think objectively most people would agree that what takes away from the match as an A++++ is that Real Madrid didn't play well in the first half. They competed, but they looked lost. There was a dopey tackle from Varane to give away the penalty. The penalty was converted beautifully, after which I thought the second half had a great deal. Okay, Juve drifted away. Juve fans will be saying to me, maybe we played as badly in the second half as Real Madrid in the first, but I thought Real Madrid looked cogent. They looked as if they're beginning to click. They certainly showed desire up front. The Benzema coming to life again is almost as interesting as the Bale-Ronaldo partnership. Three games, three goals, four assists for Gareth Bale. What the hell more do you want? Ronaldo running away with the Champions League top scorer prize this season, pre-camp now at the moment, when the Ballon d'Or votes are being cast. For me, you're right, it was engrossing, thrilling. I'm a personal fan of Fernando Llorente, partly because of his skills and his hard work, but knowing him, I like him a lot. He's one of the football world's articulate, intelligent, admirable guys, and life's been tough for him for a couple of years to get two goals and two ties against Madrid, one of which finally counted for a point, will do him the world of good towards his Juventus career, but towards the World Cup with Spain next summer. So to me, you're right. If it wasn't five star, it was 4¾ star. Hugely enjoyable to watch, and a passionate, passionate crowd played in what's been a very successful new stadium project for Juve. I love the Comunale. I went and worked in the Comunale with the former Celtic manager, Tommy Burns, when we were invited over there by Juventus to go and watch Gianpietro Vintroni, the fitness trainer who worked under Lippi. And Lippi sat us down in the cafe, Tommy Burns and I, and showed us on a small football board with little pins his formation that he was going to use to play Real Madrid in the spring in that Champions League. They beat Real Madrid over two ties. They went on to win that season. Lippi sat down over a cafe table and explained to Tommy Burns, each man for Madrid and Juve, what his concept of how the game would play was, how he was going to prepare. The Comunale, to me, was everything that the Delle Alpi wasn't. And now the Juventus Stadium seems to me to have brought back some of the passion of Turin. And Juventus are a club that excites me at the moment. Vidal excites me. Pogba excites me. It's extraordinary to see Buffon and Pirlo still excellent at these ages. Conte, I always admired as a footballer for his work and his increasing intelligence as he got older. And as a coach, he's been exemplary. So to me, you put your finger on it. It was two great, great, great European clubs thrashing out and unable to separate themselves, not for the want of quality or effort.
Graham, you mentioned Varane and his slightly clumsy challenge that led to the penalty. And it really, to me, that's one of the few times we've seen this young centre-back who just shot onto the scene last year in the Champions League especially, where he suddenly looked a little bit out of his depth yesterday evening and he didn't look completely comfortable. And similarly, what did you make of Varane playing alongside Pepe then as that centre-back role and Ramos being put out on the right-back position for Madrid?
What I made of it is that, not for the first time, it's hats off to Ancelotti. He's having a rough ride here, Ollie, and I think a lot of it's unjustified. I'm not saying, you know, break out the hankies, because when he signed on, he knew what Real Madrid was like. But I thought his work in the Clásico was far better than he was given credit for. He'd made experiments, and he was hammered in Spain, because they always know better. What a stupid experiment that was. What an idiotic idea that was. Okay, it didn't work. But experimentation in sport, or anything, any art, creative art, can lead you to discard certain ideas and get still firmer about certain ideas, even if you've lost. One of the great things about youth football, the UEFA Champions League and the next generation over the last couple of years, has been clubs who say, well, I want to try and I want to experiment, I want to get this young guy, this 16-year-old, to play, even if he's playing his 19-year-olds, because losing in this league doesn't matter, but developing does. Well, the concept's the same. And in the Clásico, he experimented with ideas that didn't come off. Ramos in midfield, Ronaldo in the wide, and Bale down the middle to begin with. Things didn't play, and it was only when he changed that Real Madrid got better. But he brought on Jesse, and Jesse got a goal. He learned a little bit about Bale, and he learned a little bit about Ramos, and he rested Ramos. And it took no risk to put Ramos back to right back, but fullbacks have been a problem for Real Madrid over the last 3-4 games. Marcelo's level has dropped. Carvajal has shown his inexperience for the first time. Arbeloa's looked lacking in pace, and the fans are getting on his back. And Ancelotti chose an intelligent solution that I have to admit most people didn't see coming, which is Varane and Pepe at centre-back. Don't leave one of the centre-backs out. Put Ramos back to his old position. Second half particularly, Ollie, I thought Ramos was excellent. To me, Ancelotti needs to be given far less knifing in the media and to have far fewer agendas played out, presidential agendas, anti-presidential agendas played out against him. And as such, I salute him for his bravery and his intelligence, and he's trying to develop a system which accommodates the must-play players, and that's not easy. And it was brutally difficult without Alonso, because at the moment the most accommodating system to get the talents all together is 4-3-3. Eventually, I think it'll go back to 4-2-3-1, but the 4-3-3 without Alonso was difficult. 4-2-3-1 without Alonso was next to impossible. And while one club can't, a big club can't depend on one man, Alonso's influence there has been allowed to grow, because even though Yarramendi is meant to be his successor in due course, Yarramendi is, and played for Sociedad, where mistakes are accepted, they aren't life or death, he's still young, he lacks experience, he's not played a great deal for Spain, he hasn't played any Champions League football before this season, and neither Modric nor Khedira exactly mimics Xabi Alonso. So if Alonso now stays fit, his talent, his intelligence, his vision, his leadership, his organisation, his positional sense on the pitch, what his movement allows other players to do, that will begin to bring equilibrium, that much-prized asset for a football team. And if you bring equilibrium to a team that was already scoring goals for fun, and you add equilibrium to the defence in front of whichever four you want to play, best four, on form, in my view, Ollie, is Marcelo on the left, Varane and Ramos in the middle, and Carvajal on the right. They're not all in form at the moment. Once they are, and you pick either one of those exceptional goalkeepers, I'm still a Casillas man, Madrid become a threat. And therefore, while they don't look this instant like Champions League winners, to rule them out, even to rule them out in light of how mechanically, metronomically well Bayern Munich are playing, is inane. In due course, if the ship stays steady, Madrid are potential Champions League winners.
They do, I have to agree with you there, Graham. They do make up that kind of three or four sides that you can see, despite Bayern Munich looking like they could potentially run away with it, still competing and possibly winning this year's Champions League. We have to look ahead to tonight's game as well, very quickly. Two games, Atletico Madrid taking on Austria Vienna, and then Barcelona taking on AC Milan tonight. You said when you joined us today, Graham, that you thought Barca-AC was a very intriguing tie, but surely in the Nou Camp, the last two games, Barca have scored seven against Milan the last time they've met here. Paper and form as well surely gives Barca a big upper hand in this one.
Yeah, both of them do. I'm not certain how relevant that is, because in the first game, in the 3-1 game, if I'm right, which certainly caused Milan's elimination 2 years ago, the game was much tighter. There was a slightly bizarre penalty decision at a corner. Milan were in that tie, no question about it. And the second time, Messi was electric. Barcelona were electric. They were losing 2-0. They needed the fourth goal to be sure, so that a away goal couldn't trouble them. It came late, very late. Looking at the paper, those two scores are healthy. But I also go back to the group game of a couple seasons ago, which was 2-2. I go back to the fact that Milan outplayed Barcelona for half an hour a couple of weeks ago on a bad pitch, admittedly, at the San Siro. I also go to the fact that while I think we shouldn't be, you know, wailing and gnashing our teeth about Leo Messi's form at the moment, without him and without the incessant mechanical ice hockey fast passing of the Pep Guardiola era, Barcelona are currently just a very good team, not an exceptional team. And as such, if Milan have a good day and Barca have a bad day, there's not a 4 or 3 goal margin in this. If it goes the other way and Milan play as miserably as they have in some of their matches, particularly at the weekend in Serie A, and Barcelona have a very good day, then sure, there could be 3-4 goals in it. But right now, with the pitch, you know, Dani Alves saw fit to complain about the quality of the Camp Nou pitch. With a team where Neymar has had a very good season but hasn't yet scored in the Champions League, where I think either Iniesta or Xavi will sit on the bench, with Balotelli, Balotelli at full tilt, holds many of the things Barcelona don't like. Running hard at a slightly flat-footed back four, aerially very good, although Barcelona have diminished the number of goals, they're losing the headers, it's still probably their biggest weak point. As such, you go back to Milan are also a great Champions League club. You know, there's significantly more of these trophies than Barcelona, and there's a reason for that. They're in a pitiful state at the moment. They don't have as much talent, but they are aggressive, they do work hard. It'll be Pavlovian. The bell will ring and the dogs will come out looking for food. And I'd also point out that over the last seven ties between these two sides, in just over 2 years, it's been 21 goals. And Milan have had a share of those. Until Barcelona hit top gear, until Barcelona proved tonight that they're at their maximum intensity, irrespective of Milan looking cornered, looking as if they're in trouble, they are, I think they're a dangerous Rottweiler opponent. And if you subdue them and you're in charge, fine, there's a quality gap. Until that happens, it's a dangerous tie.
What have you made of Neymar's, just quickly, Graham, before we let you go, Neymar's performances in the Champions League this year? Because obviously so much pressure coming in, and a number of people talking about, you know, Alexis Sanchez is starting to raise his game this year, Fabregas is continuing to look strong, of course, in a Barca shirt. What about Neymar on this big stage? Because you mentioned he hasn't scored yet, and obviously that will be a slightly glaring fact going into tonight's encounter.
Well, I think he stood out at Celtic Park when the goal came, and remember that Victor Valdes needed an extraordinary save, and John McGrew missed a very, very scorable header. When the goal comes, you know, the ball is played to Neymar, and he takes it and he holds and he turns and he lays off to Alexis, and Alexis makes the back post cross for Cesc Fabregas to score. That was a key moment. It's emblematic of what he's done, Ollie, because, you know, when you score, what is it? I think he scored 131 goals for Santos in Brazil already at his age, which is extraordinary. What is he, 21? And when you play like he did in the Confederations Cup, which was pretty full of flair, when he had a dull game, he would produce 6 minutes of something exceptional. He brought to the Camp Nou this tendency to exaggerate fouls, to look for bookings for other players, which certain communities in football think is acceptable. It's fine. Okay, the majority of our audience doesn't. But these are the things he brought on top of his pure talent. And therefore, to answer your question, what he's shown in the Champions League, I think, is pretty similar to what he's shown domestically in La Liga, and it surprised me. He's shown real, real self-control, discipline. He's been very measured in how he uses his flamboyance. He's one of the things that fantastically talented footballers don't always manage to do is to understand how to harness it to not only to the team but to what the coach has asked them to do. Now, Neymar has consistently done just that, subjugated the fun that he likes to have with the ball to what the rest of his teammates need. He supplied more assists than goals. But he's also done what Martinez asked him to do in the Champions League as well as domestically. Behave. Don't exaggerate fouls. Don't retaliate if you're kicked around. Don't overly complain to the referee. Make yourself a team player. Don't trample on Messi's toes. He has taken me aback. Not that means I take back what I wrote for ESPN in the summer, that I think that Neymar's purchase wasn't the most important purchase for Barcelona. And I thought then, and I think still, it holds the capacity to threaten Leo Messi's degree of satisfaction at the Camp Nou. I think these menaces both still exist. But his ability to adapt, his maturity, his team play, I think have been exceptional. And given that he reacted to what you call the big stage when the Clásico came along by scoring the opening goal, and then making the assist for Alexis, it would be far from surprising if he dipped his toe in the water tonight against Milan. It's his stage. He's playing very well. It's his moment. His link with Alexis is very good. His link with Messi is very good. We live in Neymar times.
Graham, from a personal point of view, I really hope that he doesn't dip his toe in the goal-scoring waters of the Champions League against AC Milan tonight. But I'm sure for the neutrals and for the Barca fans everywhere, they will be hoping for exactly that. We so appreciate you taking the time out to join us today here on World Football Daily, Graham. We'll let you get down to your real business, and we look forward to catching up with you again very soon indeed, mate. Thank you so much.
Enjoy your soccer on World Football Daily.
Thank you very much indeed. We shall, and we shall enjoy the games tonight. Graham Hunter joining us here on World Football Daily, talking all things Spanish football. And of course, Madrid with that 2-2 draw last night. The first draw between Madrid and Juventus in European competition between these two sides. 15 encounters before they had a draw until last night, number 16. And of course, Real Sociedad drawing with Manchester United. Didn't have a chance to cover that too much with Graham. We'll try and cover it a little later on. And didn't have a chance to talk Atletico Madrid either. They take on Austria Vienna tonight, but Barca taking on AC Milan. A tasty tie indeed, giving us a bit of hope. But I still think, you know, you're talking about... he does say that this is a Milan side that, yes, the dogs will come out and eat, but at the same time, you know, this is a Barca side that is playing still not world's best football, but very, very, very good football indeed. And Milan, as he said, woeful on the weekend. I wonder if that will have an impression or if they can raise their game for the fixture against Barca tonight. We do have another fantastic guest ready and waiting to join us here on the line on World Football Daily. As if covering Spanish wasn't enough today, we are going to head a little east of Spain and drop in across into France and, of course, have a chat about all things Paris Saint-Germain and Marseille's big encounter tonight against Napoli. Joining me now on the line is the man to do all of that, and always a man who we look forward to chatting with. It's Goal.com's very own Mr. Robin Berner here on World Football Daily. Robin, it's a pleasure to have you back, mate. How are you today? Hope you're very well indeed, man.
Yeah, I'm really good, Ollie. Thanks very much.
Fantastic. I'm glad to hear you're in a high spirits. Maybe, though, dampened slightly by, I don't want to say a disappointing performance, but a disappointing result for PSG, possibly against Anderlecht last night?
I don't think it would be going too far to say that it was a disappointing performance, particularly off the back of so many good showings from Laurent Blanc's team. To draw 1-1 at home with Anderlecht, particularly after beating them so convincingly in Belgium, it would have to be considered to be a fairly big disappointment, even though their place in the next round is virtually secure. We're expecting more from PSG, and for them to produce such a flat showing was certainly a little bit disappointing, yeah.
Was it a flat showing? Was it a case that maybe Anderlecht just caught them off guard? Because they really took the game to PSG last night.
Yeah, I think there's certainly an aspect. That's certainly an aspect of what went wrong for Paris Saint-Germain last night. Anderlecht were a whole lot better than they had been in the first leg. They were so much more combative, so much more in your face. They looked more organised, more experienced. They brought back some experienced players, and that certainly had a big improvement on their performance. But yeah, certainly the Belgians certainly stepped their game up, and Paris Saint-Germain failed to respond.
Where were the weaknesses that the Anderlecht exploited last night for PSG? What do you think was the weakest part of that performance yesterday?
I think certainly the biggest disappointment in Paris Saint-Germain's performance was that Zlatan Ibrahimovic was perhaps a little bit disappointing, which is in complete contrast to his form recently, because he's obviously been so explosive, most notably against Anderlecht in the first game between the teams. I didn't think Paris were particularly effective going forward. They didn't move the ball quick enough, and when they did, when they got into good positions, they were quite wasteful. And certainly Lucas Moura, he was one of the players who disappointed me the most yesterday, because I really felt that it was a chance for him to really stamp his authority in the Paris Saint-Germain team, to really stake a claim for a first-team place again. But he was wasteful, and I was quite disappointed by him. And I think Anderlecht just putting a little bit more pressure on Paris all over the field, certainly physically, made a big difference to their performance.
Robin, in terms of Moura, since he's joined this PSG side, there was a lot of talk about him, although we did actually have some people on World Football Daily say that they thought maybe he wasn't ready or wasn't as good as some people expected. Has he been as good as you've hoped? And is he improving in this PSG side? Because, of course, you hear all the time about Ibrahimovic, Cavani now as well, hogging those headlines. Moura's not getting much praise kind of globally on the internet, on the press front. What do you make of him at the moment?
For me, he's been a player who's underperformed. I don't think there's any doubt about that. He's kind of flattered to deceive at times. He's shown that he's got great potential, but it's never really come out for him in games. He's maybe beaten two or three players and produced 5-10 seconds of absolute magic, but then followed it up with a poor decision or a poor finish. Basically, his game's not quite as polished as the likes of Ibrahimovic and Cavani, who have completely snatched the spotlight from him. As a result, he's fallen to the bench, and I think he's going to struggle to get back in the team as things stand at the moment, which is a shame because he is certainly a player with immense potential, but for the money that Paris paid out for him last January, I don't think they've seen much return in terms of that yet. But that's not to say that he's a lost cause entirely, but it seems like he's a little bit low in confidence, and you know that needs to be built up before he's going to become a real star again.
I suppose PSG fans, though, when they look at the amount of money and the players that they've brought in, the number of players that have done well in this PSG side since coming in for large amounts of money, Moore, do you think he's one of the exceptions that almost proves the rule that PSG have been buying well?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty fair thing to say. I don't necessarily think all of Paris Saint-Germain signings have been immensely successful. I mean, you've got to look at Xabi Pastore as well, who's certainly at the moment really struggling to get into the team, even more so than Lucas. And even Cavani, even though he's their top scorer in the league, he's not been immensely effective for them in the position that he's been played, although you can't really blame him for that because it's not playing out on the right wing is not where he would ideally want to play, and he's kind of being shoehorned into the team at the moment, albeit he is to some extent being successful. But I think overall, PSG's transfer policy has been very effective, and I don't think you could really have too many quibbles with it at the moment.
Is there maybe a slight bit of worry last night from watching this game? Dizou's goal, wonderful piece of passing play from Anderlecht, but the ease in which they were able to splice open that defence. Do you think other defences from top Champions League potential winning sides would have been able to deal with that sort of passing, or was this just PSG getting beaten by a very good piece of Champions League football?
In my opinion, it was just a very good piece of football. I think generally Paris Saint-Germain's defence has fared up quite well this season. And that's despite playing maybe a slightly more adventurous system under Laurent Blanc. Certainly the way he's playing with the throwbacks further up the field and much wider, it does invite teams to be able to counter-attack into them, but you wouldn't expect a team to be able to pass through them quite so easily. But I think Anderlecht need to be given a lot of credit for that goal last night because it was a very nice piece of football. And I don't think you'll see PSG cut open quite as easily very often this season.
Let's hope PSG fans especially that doesn't happen, and that, you know, especially when you get Thiago Silva back into that back four, they look so strong at points. There's a big game, of course, tonight for French football, Marseille against Napoli. It's a lost cause, if you will, the Champions League at the moment for Marseille, though, isn't it, Robin?
Yeah, absolutely. They've yet to pick up a point in the competition so far this season, and to be honest, they've not really looked like they've been able to threaten any of the teams in their group who have just outclassed them in every single match so far, and I'd be surprised if the same didn't happen again tonight.
We saw kind of the protests from the fans where a year or so ago when Marseille were playing some pretty shoddy football at times. I mean, is there slightly less of an expectation around this side at the moment, and is this poor performance in the Champions League in a tough group being accepted in France?
I don't know if it accepted is the word. I think the French media and certainly the Marseille fans would have expected their team to produce a more sort of combative showing, a more maybe streetwise showing. They've certainly been very disappointing, and I think there's a certain degree of unhappiness and lots of pressure building on their coach, Elie Boek, at present because their form has been so poor. And it's important to notice that it's not just in the Champions League they've been disappointing, also in the league after making quite a good start. They've been very poor in the last maybe 2 months, and they've started to slip down the table. And as a result, the pressure is really starting to build on everybody around the club, particularly since the football they've been playing has not been particularly pretty.
Now, Marseille, you mentioned the pressure kind of turning up on Elie Bope, and we heard in the a couple of weeks back about there possibly being a crunching point coming soon for Bope and his managerial spell at Marseille. But in general, they're not a side that have, well, especially with Didier Deschamps most recently, who have rushed into managerial decisions. Do you see this being a smart move if they do get rid of Bope because of some poor performances in the Champions League and obviously not a phenomenal start to Ligue 1 this season?
Well, I have to admit, he's not a coach that I particularly enjoy because of his style of play. I find him very, very, very tough to watch because his teams are so negative. And the Marseille fans don't really like that. They like to see a sort of swashbuckling team, a team that will go out and attack games. And I think his style, you know, it was always going to be quite difficult for him to marry into the sort of Marseille mentality. And I think initially he did quite well because of, he was winning games, basically. To get that Marseille team that he had last season into the Champions League was a fairly big achievement. This season, I think they're really struggling. It's coming off the back of some more selling in the summer. They've not really got the depth in the team, but I think the fans want to see a bit more passion, a bit more excitement in their players. And I don't think they'll really get that under Bope. It really depends on who the Marseille board have got lined up to come in. But I don't think a change would do a great deal of harm to the team, to be honest.
What kind of a calibre manager, though, would they be able to bring in at Marseille? Because when Ligue 1 is starting to evolve and develop into this PSG Monaco kind of dynasty at the moment, it must be difficult for Marseille to think about attracting a top manager to come down to the south of France and change things.
Yeah, absolutely. Marseille's big trouble at the moment is all financial. That's why they're struggling on the field. That's why their squad doesn't have great depth, and that's part of the reason why Bope's struggling to get a competitive team together for the Champions League. Who they could get, it's difficult to say. They're probably looking for somebody in France, which, you know, probably restricts their options in terms of a top manager. You know, they're not going to get anybody of the calibre of Claudio Ranieri or even Laurent Blanc. They're really looking at sort of, maybe a second-rate manager would be a little bit harsh, but, you know, certainly not a premier coach to come in and help their team.
It's going to be a difficult period ahead for Marseille. It's going to be even more difficult tonight away against Napoli. And it's a Napoli side that's going to be really going for a victory tonight, obviously, with everybody else on 6 points in that group. Do you give Marseille a chance at all of forcing Napoli to stumble slightly, Robin?
Well, Bope's good at setting up his teams to be defensive and solid, so they do have that to fall back on. But overall, I just can't see this Marseille team really threatening Napoli. I would expect it to be quite a comfortable home win, I would suggest, by at least a couple of goals.
And just quickly on last weekend's action as well from Ligue 1, Robin, because there's plenty to talk about with that second against third place game, Lille against Monaco. And Monaco stumbling, have done well against PSG in their early encounter this year, but Lille proved to be too tough a task for them. What was the reasons for Monaco's defeat on the weekend?
Well, I think quite simply it was Lille's defensive play. At the back this season, Lille have been absolutely outstanding. They've kept, I think it's 10 clean sheets in 12 Ligue 1 matches, which is a remarkable record. And once again, they were really, really solid as a unit against Monaco. Even when their back four was breached, goalkeeper Vincent Wanyama had an absolutely outstanding game. He made two or three world-class saves, including a pivotal block on Radamel Falcao just before, literally 30 seconds before, Lille went up and scored their crucial second goal. So it's really a defensive effort from Lille at the moment. And René Girard setting them up so well. They're a really tough team to break down. And I think if they can continue to be so solid, they'll be up there at the end of the season. And at the moment, they're really looking like the third force in France at present.
And it's fantastic to see after that disastrous year, especially the start to last year, going into that new stadium and falling flat on their faces at the beginning of the season. Now Lille suddenly are starting to achieve that potential that we thought they had going into last season.
Absolutely. They're a very well set up and very well run club. For them to have changed their style so much so quickly, Rudy Garcia had them playing in a very attacking style. and René Girard is almost completely based around their defence. For them to have changed and for them to have made that transition so swiftly and so smoothly is really quite remarkable, and it's really nice to see.
And the big game coming up this weekend, really, Olympique Lyonnais taking on Saint-Étienne. Saint-Étienne, who were a side last year that were led a lot by Pierre Aubameyang, and Lyon, a side that continue to maybe underperform in French football. This is a game of two sides that we expect a lot more than we get from. Would you, is that a fair judgment on this game this coming weekend, Robin?
Yeah, absolutely. Particularly Saint-Étienne, in my view. Lyon have obviously been weakened by a lot of players leaving the club over the last year. Whereas Saint-Étienne, even though they have lost Aubameyang, I would say their squad's perhaps looking even stronger than it did last year, at least in terms of their depth. And in recent weeks, they've struggled to put results together. Even though they might have played well, they're throwing away points. For example, against Paris Saint-Germain a couple of weeks ago, they led 2-0 with half an hour to go and ended up drawing 2-each. That's been very, very typical of their performances lately. And they're just not clinical enough. They need to become more ruthless and really finish matches off in a better fashion.
Do we need these sides to become more ruthless, more clinical, to keep French football almost its flame going still? It was great, I think, for many people to see Lille taking second place off Monaco and to see them getting in between the big two at the top of the table. Do you get people have started to become, at the beginning of this season especially, a little frustrated by the fact that it is Monaco PSG, and then very little else coming through behind them and so far behind them?
Certainly in the media, the Monaco PSG have absolutely dominated the headlines. On the field, I don't get that impression quite yet. I mean, obviously, financially, there's a lot of jealousy towards these two teams. However, they've not really been dominant for long enough to really, you know, make it a sort of boring dynasty yet. They're not dominant in France like Real Madrid and Barcelona are absolutely dominant in Spain. Although maybe in 3-5 years' time down the line, that will come. At the moment, though, I think there's enough freshness in the league to sustain it for the moment.
Well, let's hope, Robin, that is the case, and let's hope that fixtures like the Derby du Rhône do keep us getting drawn elsewhere into French football. But for the time being, Robin, we bid you a big thank you for joining us here on World Football Daily to take us through a bit of PSG, a bit of Marseille as well before their encounter tonight, and a look ahead to the big game in French football coming up this weekend, Saint-Étienne against Lyon.
Anytime, Ollie.
Thank you so much. Robin Berner from Goal.com joining us here, talking all things French football. Robin, the Graham Hunter of French football, if you will, chatting with us. And a big thanks to both Robin and Graham. It is the Derby du Rhône. It's one of the derbies that's almost a little lost in European football. It's not many people get excited about it, but there is a strong rivalry between Saint-Étienne and Olympique Lyonnais.